Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires that we call the internets is Joe, Crazy Writer. How you doing today, Joe?
I've been better. I got all depressed over the weekend because I saw an ad that you posted saying that Deathmate's going to return. So I've been eating real light and pumping my stomach and just getting ready for its return.
Deathmate already returned with the new Valiant.
Oh, I must have missed that. Hang on, let me get my barf bag. Here we go. I'm ready. What did I miss?
All right. In the new Valiant, they did bring back a character called Geomancer. Geomancer's child was a character named Deathmate. That's what that ad was about.
Big.
And, you know, there you go. It's such a big hit that nobody knew about it.
So that means that I spent all weekend at a con snapping up copies of Deathmate for no reason. Well, not really. I ended up with a copy of Deathmate Black that looks like it was signed by Jim Lee.
Ooh.
I can't. And you know what I paid for it?
Tree Fitty.
Well, take away the tree and you got it.
50 cent.
50 cent. Yeah. Some guy was just blowing stuff out. And I picked it up just because he had another book I wanted. And I didn't bring quarters with me. So I figured, what the heck? I'll pick this up. And then I get home. Hey, there's a signature on the side there. It might be Silvestri. I really can't tell, but I'll have to do some comparison. Could be Liefeld for all I know. I don't know. We'll figure it out.
Liefeld is actually, when people will show a Liefeld signature, he'll actually say whether it's his signature or not. How he knows, I have no idea.
No scribbles.
Because let's face it, you know, I doubt he remembers every book he's ever autographed. But, no. You know, hey. You know.
But he's got, he's actually got some thing going where it's like, if you go to get his autograph, it's like, what, $75 a pop? And if you want him to sketch something, it's upwards in the thousands. And I'm like, oh, I can't believe he's charging so much. And I'm like, I can't believe he's charging so little. He probably makes more on a single cover than you and I probably make in a year.
Yeah. Well, the original art would sell for enormous amounts of money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most of the time when he does it, it's a variant cover. Matter of fact, there's a Lady Death Kickstarter going right now where he did a cover, the first time he's ever done Lady Death. Unfortunately, it's only available in the master set, which is like $100 or $200 or $300, where you get one of everything. And as much as I like the cover, I don't like that many. I did that once where I went to the top tier and I bought everything from Lady Death, and it was fun, but I don't want to do it again.
How much did it sell for when you put it out on the webs? Because heaven knows you're not keeping it.
Oh, I don't have it because I didn't buy it.
Oh, I thought you'd bought it, yeah, and sold it.
No. I was just talking about something in a previous deal where it's like, you can go to the top and get every single variant cover. And I did. And then I kept the ones I liked, blew out the ones I didn't, made my money back.
Which is the important thing.
Yes. At least I think I made my money back. After a while, it just all blurs. You look at a book and you're like, I know I paid $15 for it. It's only going for $5 on eBay, so I'll sell it for $4. Gotta take a loss occasionally.
Everything blurs eventually.
It does. It does.
Now, normally, what we like to do after we do previews is we do reviews, because yes, we read a lot of comics.
It's the News Who Review Comic Rat. Oh, never mind.
Please don't do that, because I am already getting ads.
Childhood flashback.
The children of the creators of the News Who Review, they have ads because they're selling that stuff. And I think my internet is eavesdropping on me, Joe.
I know it is, because I decided I was going to get Chris some sexy lingerie for our anniversary, and I looked it up, and that's a lot of money for something we're not going to wear much. And then for the next 2 months, that's all I got. Emails, Facebook ads. Hey, here are some lingerie you can get. And I'm like, okay, I hope nobody's looking over my shoulder, but oops, put it back.
Lingerie. One of my friends is following the Iditarod, which is this dog race up in Alaska. And I don't mean just, you know, reading about it. I mean, paid the money to watch the live cams.
Oh, wow.
Has it on all day while they're working. And I was like, oh, cool. And they said, and the cool thing about it is, you know, half of the top 10 are women, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know anything about the Iditarod. So she explains it to me. All of a sudden in my Google News, which is supposed to be politics, comics, wrestling, and video games. That's what's supposed to be in my Google News. I start getting updates on the Iditarod. Look, Google, I don't want to hear about sports that are not predetermined. Okay? I like wrestling because they know going in who's going to win. That's how I want my sports. But no. They're eavesdropping on me, Joe.
Yes.
You and your Homeland Security people.
Yes, they are.
You're
actually,
all following
it's
and not, I'm boring.
It's not Homeland Security. It's all the corporations because they make money on you. That's why the government hates Facebook and TikTok and all these other services, because we give them the information for free that when, like, say, the census comes around, nobody wants to give them, even though it's of a benefit to give them that information because that's how you get more tax dollars and stuff like that back into your community. But no.
So back to the reviews. We've been talking a lot about the rebirth of the Ultimate Universe. And it was put together by Jonathan Hickman. He's actually writing one of the rebirth of that universe's books. And it's very different. And I think it has a different idea than the original. The original Ultimate Universe was, these characters have been around for 30 years. Their backstories are really hard to get into. We're going to have all these movies coming out. Let's put together a line of books for the people who will learn about these characters through the movies.
Now, it started in Ultimate Invasion.
The new one did.
So if you didn't pick up that, you probably should. Because it does have a tie into the original Ultimate, which I thought was kind of neat. But in the beginning of each book, if you can't pick that up, because it's a lot of these books are going insane in back issue prices.
But they're reprinting them.
Yes, they are.
Matter of fact, Ultimate Spider-Man's on like a third printing.
Yeah, that's the one that I bought because my number one I put in a baggie and I picked up a number three to read. But you open it up and I'm just going to read it right out of it. It says, 20 years ago, the maker, not the Alpha Flight victim, but this is the Reed Richards from the original Ultimate Universe. And you can see him, I believe it's in Secret Wars, right? The
yes.
one where Doom makes Battle World?
Yes.
So he comes over. He's still around. Well, he made his move in Ultimate Invasion. So 20 years ago, the Maker prevented a radioactive spider from biting a young Peter Parker. He likewise prevented the creation of any other superheroes and formed a secret council to rule the world from the shadows. When Tony Stark learned the dark history of his universe, he sought to undo it, prompting the Maker's Council to attack Manhattan, killing thousands, and frame Stark for it. Peter Parker has lived his life unaware of the Maker's Council or the truth behind the spider, but that's about to change. In Ultimate X-Men, the Maker was locked away in a place called the City. And now the Maker's Council works to further exercise their influence on the world, including Sunfire, Viper, and Silver Samurai, who oversee the eastern territory of Hinokuni, the land of sun. There, a young girl named Isako Ichiki is about to find her life changed forever. Have you excuse me a second while I open up my very, very valuable copy of Ultimate Black Panther. In this one, let me find the intro. Let's see. In this one, the Maker was locked away in a place called the City, and now the Maker's Council works to further exercise their influence on the world, including Ra and, how do you say, Khonshu?
Yeah.
Who oversee the continent of Africa. But just as the city's doors closed, the door of Wakanda, an impenetrable kingdom concealed from the west of the world, have begun to open. So all this stuff has happened. And again, that's Ultimate Invasion. But then the setup for each of the three series that have come out so far, Ultimate Spider-Man, Ultimate Black Panther, Ultimate X-Men, are right there in the beginning. Sorry, I'm putting my Black Panther back until we get to the review part. So you can jump on board. The nice thing about this, you pretty much know the characters. You know who is supposed to be there. You're going to be introduced to everybody. And you're going to watch as things unfold. And you figure out, as we did, you know, previous knowledge from the Marvel Universe, previous knowledge from the previous Ultimate Universe, and also what's going on now in the Ultimate Universe. Anything before we jump into reviewing these?
My first thing about it is, while it's really cool and I really like the setup because I'm a big Jonathan Hickman fan, I'm wondering what the reason for this is, other than Ultimate Universe nostalgia, Jonathan Hickman wanting to play with things. The original Ultimate Universe had that goal. Now, the problem with it was there were two things that went wrong. Now that we look back on it, the first is that Mark Miller decided he was going to be super edgelord and do stuff that ended up being creepy, like the Hulk eating the Wasp or Quicksilver and the Wasp being involved in an incestuous relationship. So those books no longer became, well, other than Ultimate Spider-Man, those books quit being a, here's a cool introduction to the Marvel Universe for the people who watch the movies. Because I think if you went and saw the Avengers and then read a book about Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch bumping uglies, you'd probably go, ew!
Yeah.
But and Ultimate of course, Spider-Man...
They got way too edgy because they finally... What was the big one where... Magneto shifted the pole. Yeah. Basically wiped out and killed pretty much all of Manhattan.
And the problem with that was it went from kind of a world outside your window to a, okay, this is an alternate universe that is much darker than the Marvel Universe. The Marvel Universe had kind of shifted its tone to make it much more new reader friendly by not relying so much on the past and instead sort of, everybody called it writing for the trade, but it was more, we're not going to tell stories about past stories anymore. We're just going to tell stories. So in a way, the Ultimate Universe's reason to come about went away. So they decided, well, we could do whatever we want. And in a lot of ways, my opinion is they ruined it.
Yeah.
The good thing is...
I mean, there was some... I actually enjoyed that... What was that storyline where... Namor or Magneto shifted the poles?
Ultimatum.
Ultimatum. As its own story, I enjoyed it. But the problem is...
What do you do afterward?
Yes. Granted, they threw Art Galactus in that universe. So they ended it pretty well. And it all kind of came back in Secret Wars, whatever. What I like is that they didn't... They actually made, like, Miles Morales, which was probably the breakout star of the original Ultimate Universe, relevant in our universe, the 616 universe. again, they had the big Death of Spider-Man storyline, but then what? Fine, you killed off Peter Parker. Now what? Now, you brought up an interesting point, and I think you've actually, in Ultimate Spider-Man, it kind of, and again, these are big spoilers, so if you haven't read it, go find a copy, or wait for the book, or wait for this podcast, or just skip to Freaking and Geeking. But they actually kind of reveal, I think, where Hickman's going with this. And if, I don't know if we, it's actually at the end of Ultimate Spider-Man number one. And what happens is, I don't know, do we want to go there? Do we want to talk about the setup first?
Well, let's talk about the setup first.
Okay, yeah, because I'm already jumping at the end. We got like, I have two issues of Ultimate Spider-Man as we are recording this, and one of everything else.
So Ultimate Spider-Man is written by Jonathan Hickman, drawn by Marco Cricchetto. He also inks it. There are a whole bunch of variant covers. And we start with a Peter Parker in his 30s. He's married to Mary Jane. They have two kids. He works at the Daily Bugle, which is owned by, well, the chairman of the board is J. Jonah Jameson, and the editor-in-chief is Ben Parker.
Now, before you ask where May went, remember what I talked about earlier. There was a big-ass 9/11 type event that Stark got blamed for. May died in it. So that's your twist right there. You know, oh, so the universe is already different from what we know. And I kind of enjoyed the reveal on that because it was fun. I genuinely like books that have a different universe, different continuity, because you try to figure out what's going on. And in this case, it actually worked. And I'm going to, there's a panel I'm going to jump to. If you've got your copy and you don't mind ripping through it, no page numbers. Okay, so Peter Parker goes to the Daily Bugle, and he gets there. Hello, Betty. Hello, Peter. Any word on Parker? Parker! J. Jonah Jameson, classic, running into Parker. Oh, hey there, Peter. Morning, boss. How are you? No time for chit-chat. Parker! Flip the page. Boom, Ben Parker, managing editor. Parker! That's who Jonah Jameson's yelling at. That sold me right there. I did not originally order any of the Ultraverse lines. I think I might have gotten Ultimate Spider-Man just because Hickman. I did not order Panther. I did not order X-Men. Well, I did order X-Men. But that to me was the hook where it was like, okay, that's a clever switch, and I actually enjoyed it. And it pretty much kept my, you keep on your toes the rest of the issues because all the clues are there. And should we tell them who's actually now in charge of the Daily Bugle?
Well, first I want to point out, we get 9 pages before we get to that point. So it's very much almost a cinematic open where we start with Peter Parker, who's got a beard. We see him put on a wedding ring. We see the kids. Then we see that his wife is Mary Jane. Then we see he works at the Daily Bugle. So they're setting everything in place page by page. It's incredibly well designed, which is what I always expect from Hickman. Every page has a kind of a beat to it where it's here's this, letting you know the differences in this world. But also, because we had that paragraph at the beginning saying 20 years ago he did not become Spider-Man, we kind of see, okay, this is what Peter Parker's life would have been if he hadn't become Spider-Man.
Now, although the big question I have is, and we don't know yet, can we assume that everything rolled out the same without being Spider-Man? I mean,
well, we also know,
why wasn't he with Betty? Is there Gwen? Is Gwen in this universe?
We don't know yet. Those things. We do know that supervillains and superheroes didn't exist.
Yeah.
So we get these story beats. The art, very good at telling the story. You know, panel to panel continuity is really good. Each page has a big reveal on it. The other thing that they do that I like, and I know a lot of people don't, in Jonathan Hickman books, he has capital letters and small letters. And before you think, well, that's not a big deal. That's how everybody writes. Comics, everything's capital letters. Has been since the dawn of comics.
Which you can tell, because if you ever catch me printing, I'd wanted to be a letterer, so I learned how to print. I can't write fast cursive, but I can print. It's not very legible anymore, but I can, that's how I do. I print everything in capital letters.
So each page gives us another reveal. Very well done. Very well staged. I love this art.
Yes.
It's not flashy. It's not in your face. It's very much serving the story rather than the story serving the art.
Marco Cecchetto.
Yep.
Cecchetto. Thank you. Yes. Oh, awesome art. Awesome art.
But as you read the story, you're going to see that there is a reveal, a difference, something unique on each page. It's very much, if you know the Marvel Universe, and let's be honest, with bajillions of movies now, anybody who picks this up is going to know who Norman Osborn is. They're going to know who Aunt May is. They're going to know who Ben Parker is. They're going to know these characters. So the differences stand out. They make you realize this. It's not a what if. It's more a this is a different version of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, which I enjoy. So what we find out is that there is a conspiracy going on. Apparently, the managing editor and J. Jonah Jameson quit the Bugle because somebody we already know, the Kingpin, apparently now is in charge of, well, they don't call him the Kingpin. They call him Mr. Fisk. But he is the paper's owner, apparently, offers the job to Parker, Ben Parker, because apparently Jonah quit. And Ben just gets up, joins Jonah in the elevator and says, so what are we going to do now? So there is a deep friendship and respect between Jonah and Ben, which I absolutely love. I just instantly love this relationship. Although, as Kingpin's leaving, somebody tried to blow him up. Somebody in a green costume on a glider. Very interesting.
The other thing that I like is we're starting off by putting our characters in crisis. There's something going on at the Daily Bugle. J. Jonah Jameson and Ben Parker quit. They're going to develop their own thing. They don't know what it is yet. And Peter Parker just feels like something's not right. There's a really good sequence between him and Mary Jane where they talk about the fact that, you know, not only has his work life changed, but he feels that something's not right. He feels that something is missing. We, of course, as readers already know, look, we're 37 pages into this book. It's called The Amazing Spider-Man. Peter Parker's the main character. We know he's going to be Spider-Man. We just don't know how.
And that's what I was revealing, or that's what I was kind of alluding to at the very beginning. There's this globe in the Parker residence that the kids have been playing with. And all of a sudden, it starts glowing. Parker, this is for Parker, Peter Parker, boom. He opens it up. Hey, we know who this is. My name is Tony Stark in Iron Man armor. And while you likely know my father's name, you probably never heard of me. Parker talks back, and then realizes it's a recording. I'm sending you this from 6 months into the future. There was an attempt on me and my companion's lives, and we only had seconds to escape before the orbital platform fired. That was the great tragedy. Again, if you watched or read, I should say, Ultimate Invasion, you knew this. I went to the only safe place I could think of, and he reveals what we've already talked about. 20 years ago, you were supposed to be bitten by a radioactive spider. This would have given you amazing powers, and with them, you would have become one of the Earth's most prominent superheroes. Instead, a great evil traveled throughout time and erased almost all the heroes from this world's existence. You are one of them. And as the globe disintegrates, inside is a vial with a spider. And Parker holds it up and decides, I want this. And you can imagine what happens at the very end. Corey, have you read issue 2 yet?
Yes, I have.
Okay, so let me find my issue 2 here. So I was dying to read issue 2. I mean, this issue 1, this was an awesome setup. So in
it is also the only one that's double sized so far. Black Panther number 1 is regular size, and X-Men number 1 is regular size.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Because they're all $5.99. So
yeah.
Okay. So in Ultimate Spider-Man 2, you get they do the setup again, which is pretty much everything we say, but it also includes what happened in issue 1. And we start finding out more what's going on. I don't want to get too much into this one, but it's pretty much a learning by baptism of fire. You know, he's figured out he's really strong. He's super agile. He must have organic webs. He does have one problem, though. After 2 weeks of practice, he's not great at stopping as he crashes into a water tower. So we still get more interplay between Jonah and Ben. Peter Parker Spider-Man meets his first supervillain. Gets totally snookered.
I actually loved that.
Yes.
What it is, so he's got an all-black costume. He's learning how to swing around the city. He's trying to figure out what he is going to do with this. And he, you know, well, I'm a superhero. I guess I have to stop crime. He sees a crime happening. Now, one of the things about the movie Spider-Man is that all of the villains are kind of pushed into where they are. You know, the Green Goblin formula caused him to go crazy. Dr. Octopus was doing this to save someone. Sandman, same thing. Except for Venom. Venom was kind of just stapled on. But the idea in Spider-Man is that his villains aren't bad people. They're people in bad circumstances. So they play off of that by having his first villain say, look, I'm only doing this to save my sister or my daughter or whatever. And he buys it because he's naive. He hasn't done this before. And of course, he gets his ass handed to him. And before people say, well, Spider-Man shouldn't get his ass handed to him, read those Ditko issues. He's always getting his ass handed to him the first time. And he has to figure out, okay, how can I beat this person so that in the second fight is when he wins? So we do get a second fight. So following the Ditko formula, it would be, okay, this time he's, gets his ass handed to him again. He's a guy in his 30s, just starting out, who's not any good at this. He's been told by Tony Stark, you're going to be one of the greatest heroes of the world. And he's terrible at it. And it just works so well.
Now, one thing I absolutely love, because obviously he's now Spider-Man, and nobody knows about it, but as he comes in home and he's reeling from getting his ass whooped, can't believe I fell for that. Let's be friends. Idiot. Guess who happens to walk in on him? About 23 people.
He's not real good at this whole secret identity thing either.
Nope. And of course, the one child who's absolutely terrified of Spider-Man just by the coverage he's getting in the Daily Bugle, his little daughter. And she's freaking out. Yes, shh, me, it's me. Why are you dressed like that guy? What if I told you he dresses like me? What? I am that guy. I've got bit by the special spider and gave me powers. And you got bit by a magic spider? Sure. So they make it kind of a secret. He bribes her with some ice cream. And Dad, yeah, I still don't like the costume. And even later on, when he comes home after getting his ass whooped the second time by the Shocker, there's this picture on there. Dad, I drew a picture of your spider. I hope you like it. You know, kind of a nice little tug ending. But what's significant about this, the Daily Bugle isn't covering the fact that this guy in a green costume and a glider is trying to assassinate the owner, Mr. Fisk. They're covering this new Spider-Man. Something that Ben and Jonah notice, something that is very much apparent to the Kingpin and whoever's in charge of him, because he ain't in charge, folks. Remember what we talked about? The Earth's been divided up into different, what do we want to call them, cabals, corporations? We don't know.
All.
We just don't know who's in charge of what. But you can tell by the opening sequences I read of the three comics, different groups are in charge of different things. The other thing that's interesting is apparently whoever this Green Goblin is saw Spider-Man get his butt whooped, or at very least saw the Shocker shock away. I will point out that if you read issue one, Norm Osborn died in the attack that we talked about, the Stark laser that fired and vaporized New York. His son gave the eulogy. Apparently he's more of a public figure because Osborn's like a big corporation or something. Same thing it was in the 616 universe. So naturally you're thinking, oh, well, that's got to be Osborn, doesn't it? It's got to be Harry. I don't think Hickman's that obvious.
No, but, I don't either.
You know, again, Harry and Peter don't know each other. Again, that might actually have answered the question I had about Gwen. We don't know where Gwen is. Maybe Peter never went to college. He just stayed a photog. No reason to go to college, especially since it was his aunt who kind of kept him going on that, keep up with science. Well, if his uncle went into the press, you know, newspaper business, I could see that dragging Peter along with it.
Also,
we don't know. I'm just surmising.
Joe, mm-hmm. When Gwen was introduced, who was her boyfriend?
Harry.
Yes.
Now I got to go back to issue one.
I do not see her in there.
Okay, that's what I'm looking for, because there's a big couple pages where Father Murdoch leads the thing, and I'm just looking. Yeah, there is no blonde woman around Harry. Anyways, I love Ultimate Spider-Man 1 and 2. I love this as much as I love Bendis' Ultimate Spider-Man. I don't care where the rest of the universe goes. I will probably stick with this one until an omnibus pops up, and then I'll sell everything off and just do omnibuses. But wait, there's more.
Yes, there is. The second of the Ultimate books was Ultimate Black Panther, which, again, I thought that was a really good choice.
Yes.
Black Panther is, I would say, outside the Marvel Universe. I'm sorry, outside of comics. Black Panther is probably one of the best-known Marvel characters now. And the first thing when I read this comic was, while Spider-Man is taking our Spider-Man knowledge and kind of twisting it, this reads to me as if it was going to be part of that original Ultimate Universe, in that this is from the movie. If you read this, it really feels like the movie in so many ways. Our creative team is Brian Hill. Our artist is Stefano Caselli. Again, no inker. So for both of these books, The artist is working on their own. They do have a colorist, but it's not, here's the penciler, here's the inker. It's, nope, we have an artist who's doing it. And we don't start with the introduction. We don't get that till page 7. We start with a scene taking place in Africa where workers are being attacked by some sort of goon that has super speed, some sort of goons, hired goons. They have super speed. They all wear the same costume. That boy looks a lot like Moon Knight in that they have a circle on their face. They have a crescent moon on their chest. They have come to claim the land. They pretty much take over in a brutal way, but we see that some of the people from Wakanda are watching, and they go back and report to King T'Challa. Then, and it says, their time will come, brother. We have seen the anger of Ra and Khonshu. Khonshu. Khonshu is the moon god. Ra is the sun god. Khonshu is the moon god of Egypt. They use it a lot in Moon Knight. Then we get that Black Panther is woken up from a nightmare. We get our introduction to Black Panther, his wife, and the country of Wakanda. A diabolical genius known as the Maker used time travel to create his ideal Earth by systematically preventing anyone from ever becoming a superhero and by establishing a secret council of supervillains that rules this world from the shadows. But recently, the Maker was locked away in a place called the City, and now the Maker's council works to further exercise their influence from the world, including Ra and Khonshu, who oversee the continent of Africa. So they might not be gods. They may be people. But just as the city's doors close, the doors of Wakanda, an impenetrable kingdom concealed from the rest of the world, have begun to open. Well, they haven't opened, because the bulk of this story is, how is Wakanda going to respond to this attack on an African country? First off, again, the art is beautiful. We don't get the same sort of twist reveal on every page. This is very much more setting up. This is the world of the Black Panther. These are the characters of the Black Panther. These are the conflicts. And these are the things that are going to draw him out into the rest of the world. When I read this book, there was a feeling of openness, even though, you know, many times it's 5 to 6 panels a page. The panels make everything seem very big, very open, very big screen. And I really like that, because it makes it seem like we have the Wakanda from the movies, which always felt huge. This sprawling technological paradise. We don't get any of the stuff about what is a Black Panther, you know, the heart-shaped root, any of that. It's more about the conflicts that are in the royal family. That Black Panther is a thoughtful king and not so much of a superhero. But as you read this, you hear even the drawing of Black Panther looks so much like Chadwick Boseman. It's very much, this is aimed at the people who watched the movie. Joe, your impressions?
I didn't originally order this because I wasn't that interested. But when the hubbub started about and the whole Ultimate line, I lucked out and was able to get a copy at the source. And they were doing like everybody else. Limit one per person. They were doing it one per whatever variant covers. So I just opted to get the original white cover. Because again, there's tons of variant covers. If you can find them, good for you. What got me on this was the final chapter. And again, I don't know what's going on. I'm not as hip on Black Panther as I probably should be. But as the band were attacking, my love blessed them, and lightning came and destroyed a ship. Is this a storm? We don't know. We never see who shot. And it was Killmonger and the Windrider that were protecting the villagers. And the what got me at the end was somebody tries a suicide attack on the king. And the king pushes his son over. And the suicide bomber kills the king as, I'm assuming it's Chakala, lands. He's in full Black Panther gear. And he gets up. Everybody acknowledges him as the king. He says, call the queen. Our enemies call themselves Moon Knight. Wakanda is at war. And I was like, oh, you got me. I mean, I enjoyed the reveal and just what was going on. And then I'm trying to think, am I really going to pick? Oh, yes, I'm going to pick this up. Well done.
A really good hook.
Yes.
And I like that it was a different storytelling style from Ultimate Spider-Man. Ultimate Spider-Man was about all the twists in the first issue. This is very much about how things seem the same, because until Wakanda and the Fantastic Four discovering Wakanda, their world would not have changed.
And as we saw what was said in Ultimate Spider-Man, not all the heroes were eliminated. But again, these are heroes that were just part of Wakanda. So they weren't like, well, I can stop Spider-Man by eliminating the spider. I can stop the Fantastic Four by stopping the rocket ship, or maybe killing Reed. Which, again, remember, the Maker is Reed. I could see him probably killing off the Reed in this world. We don't, again, tons of things we don't know. I can speculate till we fill another podcast. Which now leads us to the last book, Ultimate X-Men. Peach Momoko. You had me at that right away. This one is way out there. I can't even. This has no anchor to X-Men that I can see. And again, I read it for the first time hours before we started reading this or doing this podcast. I didn't see any Sunfire. I didn't see any Viper. I didn't see Silver Samurai. As far as I can see, it's just pretty much a young girl named Hisako and how her life has changed forever. If you like Peach's art, I love Peach's art, you're going to fall in love with this book. And I had to stop and back up a couple times and get myself readjusted to her style and the characters. Because at first, I was confused by who was talking to who. And then I got it. There's mystery. There seems to be a bad guy who knows too much. There's some flashbacks. There's been a death in her life. She's not
this,
quite.
This to me felt like a horror book.
I could see that.
And we're used to, you know, when you say X-Men, you have a certain idea in your head of the storytelling style.
Hey, look, an ad for X-Men 97.
But the X-Men, you have that idea of the Chris Claremont storytelling style. No matter who writes the X-Men, they usually fall into his sort of rhythm. Even Jonathan Hickman, when he did the X-Men, he fell into Claremont's rhythm because Claremont spent 17 years building these characters. His ideas are permeated into it. This is very much more like the Peach Momoko Demon Days stuff, where the X-Men ideas are dropped into Japanese folklore, myth, and legend. This is very much, if I were to draw a parallel, it would be like, imagine Kitty Pryde learning her powers without the X-Men coming to her, without either the X-Men or the White Queen and the Hellfire Club coming to kind of pull her in. Our lead character has powers. We're shown the powers, but we're shown them in a way that makes both us and her scared of them.
She's not quite sure. Well, I'm gonna read a single panel on the second to last page, which sums this whole book up for me. And I'm not saying it negative. And she's thinking this, what the hell is going on? And I love it. Absolutely love it. I don't know what's going on. I have no clue. I know about as much as you do. Peach is the only one who knows. And if I wasn't reading the other two already, I'd be, oh, yeah, I'm going to read this, definitely.
The way the powers...
How is this going to tie into the rest of the Ultimate Universe? No clue.
The way the powers manifest on page 19 is just beautiful. Our lead character's about to get hit by a car. Something surrounds her to destroy the car. It seems to have a fist. It seems to have a face. It seems to be coming from her or around her, but it's in such a way that she doesn't know what's going on. Now, we as readers, we automatically jump to the assumption that, oh, that's going to be her mutant power. But if you look, the manifestation of her power is like a spirit. So our character knows less than we do. That is what is pulling us through. There are a lot of mysteries here. There is a dark force that is speaking to her. There's also a mysterious boy who's trying to connect with her. We've got a mysterious past where something happened that she feels incredible guilt about. And now she's manifesting powers. There is a really nice thing in the back where they explain a lot of the cultural stuff that is used in this comic.
Oh, I didn't read that.
Yes.
I'll have to go back
and do that. Page.
Oh, there, it's right there, right on the very last page where it's "Do We Continue?" It's a lexicon is the name of it.
Yeah. So it explains why the first start of the story, someone giving her a second button is a big deal. The little charms that she has are considered a big deal. The fortune inside a charm is important. It explains why all these little things that are focused on matter, because they're things that Japanese culture knows, but we in America don't. So I like the fact that I think this is a good grab for people who like manga, but it's also a good way to sort of introduce us Marvel fans to manga storytelling style, not in how it's been used in a lot of comics, which is, you know, to get rid of the narration, have the art carry more of the action in the story, using that to sort of, it's more, okay, this is the Japanese art style. You've been introduced to it with Peach Momoku. Now we're going to use it in a series and really expand on that idea. Because I've read, you know, in the 90s, I read the Spider-Man and X-Men mangas. And the problem with the Spider-Man manga was it was from the 70s, so it was really outdated. The X-Men was just confusing, because they just threw so many characters at you at once. This is very much a different style of storytelling. And for the people who complain that, oh, American storytelling is decompressed, manga storytelling makes our decompression look like fast forwarding. So we're getting a mix of the two. Momoku's art is very, very evocative. It gives that feeling of horror when her powers manifest, or when the force that is speaking to her as she's, you know, she was told to go to the temple and this dark force appears. It really evokes that feeling of unease. It's just so well done and so well put together. all three of these Ultimate books are very much a buy.
Yes.
And I am shocked that they went insane in price. Because this was something where you and I were like, well, you know, it's Jonathan Hickman. It's going to be good. But I didn't think that it would go outside that Jonathan Hickman fanboy realm to where it is now, where it's, you know, how much is Ultimate Spider-Man number one going for?
Let me take a look here. Ultimate Spider-Man number one, first print. And do the quick switch, price plus shipping. Take away the auctions because there's plenty of people selling them. The first variant cover, the first book is J. Scott Campbell's variant cover for $24.99. After that, there's some second prints already, which I didn't get. $25. That's a second print. I can't even see the first print. Because the problem is there's so many different variants. So here we go. People are, yeah, about $30 right now. So it's not a, it's not the $40 crazy it was. But again, there's only two of them right there. So if you want one, pause the podcast, go get them. So what I'm looking for is the white cover, not any of the other variants.
Well, the good thing is they're keeping these in print. You know, they're doing, not only are they doing second and third prints, but they're turning those second and third prints out fast.
Oh, yeah. Like and I could not find my Black Panther first print because I basically, I got it home, I read it, I put it in a baggie. I might flip it, I don't know. But I was able to get a second print finally. So I do have one to read. And then I found my first print. So never mind.
So
I find my signed peach though.
So now, Joe, back in the day when you ran a shop, how long did it take for you to get a second print? Let's say something sells out first day. Marvel says, we're going back to print. How long would it take?
If I was lucky, I would get it by the time issue 2 came out. More likely, I recall it showing up about issue 3. Because what has happened is they've refined the system so as to the final cutter order cutoff date, retailers could probably bump up their number 2s before number 1 hit, especially once they see number 1 sells out. I had a great relationship with my Diamond rep, and what did we figure? It was like 80% of my new comic book sales were to my subscribers. If I knew I was going to sell out, first of all, most of my subscribers were covered. And because we had two other hot comics, if I needed to get the hot book for a subscriber, I could always count on one of the other stores, which was really cool. And I would do the same for them. But if I knew, say, like Ultimate Spider-Man coming out and it's hot, hot, hot beyond belief, again, no eBay, no interwebs, you would know it's hot the minute it sells out and maybe Schindler's down the block had it already for $20 on the wall. I would call right away, not only reorder number 1, but I would bump my orders up for 2 and 3, because by that time I probably already placed my order for 3. I'm working on 4. So we were literally hot comics. We knew what was coming largely because of the subscriber base. If I had guys suddenly calling me, hey, can you grab me that Ultimate Spider-Man? Can you grab me that Ultimate Spider-Man? Very, very rarely did I have to say, I'm going to have to cover you with a second print. And that was something that was just inherent with hot comics. Remember, was it Alpha Flight 51 or was it 55? The Jim Lee, I am gay issue.
No, that was way later than that.
But
Jim Lee didn't draw that issue.
Okay, but it's still, it hit the press. Everybody and their uncle wanted it. And I was, oh yeah, that was before I even owned the shop, because I remember calling up and asking, hey, can you pull me a copy? And they're like, well, I'm not sure. Everybody's asking. I'm not sure if I'll have enough. And I said, no, that's fine. If you have one, I'd like to get one. And they covered me, which was really cool. I remember buying Solar number 10, if you remember way back when, talking
black
about
that cover.
Yeah. Totally shocked everybody. Again, a second print showed up. I was down at Kansas City Con, and my marching orders from Dan and Brian were to pick up as many of these as I could find. They ate the cost to make sure their subscribers got one at cover price. And that was something that when Pat and I bought the shop, I continued that. I even to the point where I would sell people my copy of a book if it sold out, because then I'd either get it from another Hot Comics, or I'd run up to Shinders or whatever. Again, that was something we had an advantage of, because Shinders got their books about 6 hours after we did, if they even got them the same day. And while we didn't run there and wipe them out of books, it wasn't a big deal to go up and like pick up 2-3 copies. So yeah, we were pretty fortunate in the way this would happen. There was very rarely a book that came out that we could not cover a subscriber for. And of course, if there was, and you might remember more than I would, Corey, we would put out the old only one per person.
Yeah.
And the, I can't remember outside of Death of Superman doing that. I'm sure I'll think of it. If I do, I'll mention it in another podcast.
I think you've just, Joe, it sounds like that you've gone underwater.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm busy. Now that I've read my Ultimate Spider-Man, I am busy trying to bag them up. So I keep them in minty mint shape.
You know what else you should do if you're looking to go underwater?
Hold my breath a really long time.
Or contact our sponsors, these guys. Our newest sponsor is NordVPN. Let's be honest, if you're out on the internet, you need a VPN to protect you. There's all sorts of things going on the internet where people can track you. You could accidentally download a keylogger, all sorts of things. NordVPN gives the best security possible. It has a password manager which generates complex passwords, syncs across all your devices, stores your notes and credit card information. It also gives you 10 gigabytes of private cloud storage, secure files that backs up your data automatically. But the main thing it gives you is peace of mind. It gives you peace of mind when you're out on the internet, when you're streaming, when you're playing games, when you're listening to podcasts like this one. It gives you safety anywhere at any time. It protects your online activity. You get full access to all content. And if you use the link go.nordvpn.net/SH3KU, it'll take you to where you can get a great deal for a 1-month plan, a 2-year plan, a 1-year plan. They are our newest sponsor. We're happy to have them. And if you would like to sponsor something here at any of the podcasts on the Solitaire Rose Network, you can. Just email me, solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. Thanks. And one of the things we have added over the... We keep... You know, we have segments that come and go. One of the ones that has shown up in the last year that we do more often than not is retro reviews. And it's my turn this time.
Corey's turn. Hooray. What retro review do you have for us, Mr. Strode?
Joe, do you remember last year when we took our trip up to Duluth and I bought giant-sized chillers number 3?
I remember the trip. I don't remember what I don't even remember what I bought.
But I got giant-sized chillers number 3. Now, Giant-Sized Chillers was reprinting those old horror comics, mostly from the 50s, a few from the 60s. But number 3 actually just reprinted stuff from when Marvel restarted their horror line with new stories. So these are all stories from the early 70s. There are seven stories. First is Gargoyle Every Night by Roy Thomas and Bernie Wrightson. There's also a framing sequence, which is drawn by Marie Severin. The editor-in-chief at the time was Len Wein. So Len Wein is talking to the editor of Giant Size Chillers. Tony Isabella, who's chained up in the basement, having to put together comics and write comics. He's late. Len says he's late on a story for Supervillain Team-Up, late on a story for Dracula Lives, late on The Living Mummy, and late on books you haven't even done issue one of yet. So Tony says that he's been searching for weeks to find stories worthy of being represented in this special issue of Giant Size Chillers. Really fun art from Marie Severin, who was doing her caricatures and kind of her humor art, which the weird thing is I can look at her humor art and then I can look at her Hulk art and there are minor differences, but I can instantly tell Marie Severin's art. There are other people who, when they look at her humor art, do not recognize her as the person who drew the Hulk, which is weird to me. The first story, the one by Bernie Wrightson, Roy Thomas, it's listed as Roy Thomas and Bernie Wrightson as the writers. Bernie Wrightson is the artist and inker. Bernie Wrightson did not do a lot of work for Marvel. He spent most of his time at DC. And I think part of it is that he liked the horror stuff more than the superhero stuff. So there was very little work for him to do. The first story is a twist ending story that gives Bernie Wrightson an excuse to draw gargoyles. The draw of this story is Bernie Wrightson's art, Bernie Wrightson's gargoyles. The story itself, pretty much just an excuse for that. And the next one is about Morg the Warlock. It is written by Gerard Conway and Barry Smith. Very early Barry Smith. I think it's before Conan. And Gary Conway, when he was still using his full name of Gerard Conway, which means it's very early in his career as well. It is a twist-ending story about a warlock who is imprisoned in a tree for hundreds of years, but then it starts hypnotizing this woman who, if she pulls the sword out of the tree, he will be free to destroy England. Twist-ending story. The draw of it is the Barry Windsor Smith art. Really beautiful stuff. I will say that there are some color choices that are grotesquely terrible. On page 17, they do kind of, I could tell that the colorist was trying to do a thing where she's being lit by the moon, but basically they just, okay, her skin and hair are all green. She looks like a very pale She-Hulk. And of course, it uses a lot of very 70s tricky layouts and using the lettering for emphasis. It really feels like early 70s stuff before Bernie Wrightson kind of calmed down and let his art do the story rather than, hey, I can lay out pages however I want. So if you're interested in early Barry Windsor Smith, good story for that. Twist ending is mediocre. The next is a story written by Alan Brodsky, who used to write for comics back in the 40s and 50s. And it's drawn by a man who signs his name as Jay Hawk, inked by Barry Windsor Smith. And you're saying to yourself, I don't know who Jay Hawk is. Jay Hawk was the pen name for Jeff Katz, who you may know as the person who did the indie book First Kingdom. He's another guy who worked in the 40s and the 50s and then went into advertising art. But once comic shops started, he was one of the guys at the beginning of comic shops. You had Cerebus by James Sim. You had ElfQuest by Richard and Wendy Pini, and you had The First Kingdom by Katz. The mix, however, of Katz and Barry Smith is not a good mix, because Katz's stuff is very golden age, and Smith tries to ink it to make it look more like sort of modern John Buscema. So the art does not come off well. The story itself, again, it's not a good story. It reads very much like a subpar 50s horror comic. In most of these, the art is able to carry it, but this is one where the art does not carry it. Twist ending is something that you've seen a few thousand times, so there's nothing about it that jumps out at you. The next one is Len Wein's first story for Marvel, drawn by Gene Colan. And it's Gene Colan, inked by Mike Esposito. They work together a lot at Marvel. It reads a lot like a 50s twist ending story. It's very early in Len's career, so it's overwritten. The prose is very purple. The twist is okay. The idea of it is a henpecked husband finds a book in a bookstore called The Life and Times of Harry Swan, and he's, somebody with the same name as me once wrote a book. I wonder if that Harry Swan was a loser like me. As he reads the book, he realizes it's the story of his life, and he skips ahead to see things where, I could know who's going to win the race tomorrow. I could know what the lottery numbers are. And he uses it to sort of turn his life around. But in doing so, there's the twist ending. And the next person finds the same book, and it's his name on it. So very much a Twilight Zone-y thing. I liked it for the Gene Colan art. And it's a curiosity for Len Wein's first story. The next story is the best story in the book, and that is The Monster from Chamber of Darkness number 1. It was written and drawn by Jack Kirby. John Veerpootin did the inking, and Veerpootin was one of those guys who did what Kirby... There were some people who would correct Kirby and some people who would just do what Kirby had put on the page. Veerpootin, who didn't ink a whole lot, he was a production guy, just did what Kirby did on the page. It's a very Kirby-esque story in that it's about a grotesque man who lives alone in a castle, and the villagers all think he's a monster, but there's a twist at the end. But, that splash page. The splash page is just beautiful. And for the people who say that Kirby couldn't script, this is so well done. It reminds me a lot of his Black Magic stuff he did in the 50s. But it's got the same sort of layout as his Fantastic Four. Just the art is... This is peak Kirby right here. This is the stuff he was doing to fulfill his contract before he went over to DC. And it's a shame that he did not do more of these short horror stories, because the stuff I've read in Black Magic is good, but you could tell that Kirby was doing layouts and passing it on to other people, or he and Joe Simon would put together the stories when Kirby would just do a horror story. He was really good at evoking mood and creating character for a short 7-page story, and this shows it. Just so well done. I would say out of all the stories in this book, not only is this the best, but it's pretty close to a comics masterpiece. The next story is Tom Sutton, who did a story in Tower of Shadows number 1. Denny O'Neill scripted over his stuff. Now, if you read a lot of Carlton horror in the 70s, Tom Sutton did tons of horror in that. This is a story that it's drawn in a very cartoony style. It's almost a humor, kind of a horror humor thing. the coloring does it no favors. You can tell that the colorist was very lazy because there are a lot of what they call knockout panels where it's just, okay, everything in the panel is blue. Everything in the panel is green. Everything in the panel is red. That almost obscures the art. And I think it's because Sutton was drawing in a cartoony style. It's a lot of fun. It's good for a laugh. You're not going to, it's not a story you're going to be going back 20 years from now and go, oh yeah, that was fantastic. It was just a nice, good horror humor story with a humor twist at the end. The next one is from Tower of Shadows number 4, which actually got Marvel in trouble with the Comics Code. Why? Written under a full moon by Marvin Wolfman, illustrated at the crack of dawn by Gene Cole and Joe. Why would that get them in trouble with the Comics Code?
Something about the horror.
No, you weren't allowed to have vampires, mummies, zombies, and werewolves.
They put them all in one story.
Well, they rejected the story because written by Marvin Wolfman. They actually had to make a copy of his driver's license to say, no, that's his real name. We're not saying it's written by a werewolf. His name is Marv Wolfman.
Wow.
This is colored better than the other Gene Colan story. Very, it's, again, it's a story about a fortune teller who tells a man he's going to die. So he does everything he can to try and avoid the thing that's going to kill him. But in the end, there's a twist ending. It's all about the twist ending and the art. It's very much, there are twist ending stories where everything is just leading up to the twist. There's no characterization. That's what this is. This is very much leading up to the twist.
What a twist.
I love Gene Colan's staging of this, though. Because there's a lot of talking heads and only a few pages have action in them, he moves the camera around. This is an upshot. This is a downshot. This is a side view. This so that it feels like you're watching a movie. Colan was a master at staging his stuff using movie ideas. This was also the first time Marv Wolfman and Gene Colan worked together. The next thing they worked on together was Tomb of Dracula. So when you read it, it looks a lot like their early Tomb of Dracula stuff. And that is the final story. Tony Isabella does get revenge at the end. The next issue, an all-new 25-page chiller featuring Tigra the Werewoman. Concept by Tony Isabella, story by John David Warner, art by Mike Bosberg. There was no fourth issue of Giant Size Chillers. So I believe it was Marvel Chillers that Tigra showed up in, right?
I believe so.
Let me double check. So it's another case where they took a story that had been made for the Giant Size books. There we go, Tigra. Which is weird because it says here, okay, because Tigra was the cat, they say the character was created by Roy Thomas and Wally Wood. Tony Isabella is the one who created Tigra. Somewhere along the way, the cat, Greer Nelson, was turned into Tigra the Werewoman. So Tony Isabella has been very vocal about the fact that he says he created Tigra the Werewoman, even though on Marvel's books it says it was created by Roy Thomas and Wally Wood, because Roy Thomas and Wally Wood created the character that then turned into Tigra the Werewoman. It's kind of like the fight over who created Venom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jim Shooter has said, well, I'm the one who created the black costume being alive, therefore I'm the one who created Venom. David Michelinie's the one who said, no, I'm the one who decided that the black costume would merge with Eddie Brock, And that would be Venom. Todd McFarlane says, well, I'm the one who created all the visuals, therefore I'm the one who created Venom. It gets messy. And that's why when you get to comics and they start talking about who created what, because you were in an office bouncing ideas off each other, taking one thing and turning it into another, you really can't assign creation of a character as easily as you'd think. Let's take the character Quasar.
Quasar. You mean Zenith invented it?
Well, first there was Marvel Boy.
Hey, can we give a Joe Price, anyone who gets that reference?
Yes.
Thank you.
Back in the 50s, you had Marvel Boy. It was created by the Bullpen. It was basically Martin Goodman came and said, hey, there's a Captain Marvel, this, this, this. We one of our imprints is Marvel. Let's have Marvel Boy. Okay. So they created the character. He had the bands. He came from Uranus, et cetera, et cetera. It failed. Roy Thomas brought the character back as the Crusader in the 70s, had him fight the Fantastic Four and die. That's one of the things Roy used to do that I really don't like. It's he would bring back obscure characters from the Golden Age and then kill them immediately.
He's dead, Jim.
But the bands were still around. So Roger McKenzie had someone take up the bands. And that's the character who I don't even remember what he was called. But he showed up in an issue of Captain America with the Texas Tornado and a couple other characters as a superhero team that didn't go anywhere. And then Mark Gruenwald took the character and turned it into Quasar. Did Mark Gruenwald create Quasar? Really can't say. And they say that Tigra showed up in Giant Size Creatures number one rather than Chillers number one. So they did just take that. I was sure that they had taken that and put it into two issues. What was that book that they put her in? There's Claws of the Cat, Giant Size Creatures, Marvel Chillers. Yeah, they had her show up in Marvel Chillers after the Mordred the Mystic story. So there you go. Now we get to my favorite part of the show. No, not where I go and eat a whole bunch of sour cream and dill potato chips.
With cottage cheese.
Well, sour cream and dill potato chips have become my new obsession, Joe.
Well, there's some stuff at Walmart we're going to have to pick up. I can't remember the name of it. I think it's like Rudy Tooty Fruity Booty or something. I'll...
And then there is also, remember, we've also got the Chixa. Which I can't eat.
Oh, here it is. Rudy Tooty Fresh and Fruity Lay's Potato Chip.
Oh, my God.
They're only available at Walmart. You got to get a box. I got to get some. I literally watched two TV hosts almost throw up eating them.
Oh. Now, I will say that, what was it? There was that, they did those two breakfast cereals. There was the chicken and waffle cereal and then the maple bacon. The maple bacon was amazingly good. The chicken and waffle was very much this just tastes like a whole lot of salt. So yes, we will try the Rudy Tooty Fresh and Fruity.
Yes. So I don't know when you're going to get to a Walmart. I don't know when I'm going to get to a Walmart, but that's the only place you can buy them. So,
and then you have to try the chicken pizza thing at Kentucky Fried Chicken for our American food segment. No. This is the Freaking and Geeking segment. Joe, what are you freaking on?
We have visited deaths of people we're close to way too often in this podcast. And I suppose that's just something that's going to happen as we get older. A friend of the show, someone who I don't think we've ever had on the show, but we have talked to him quite a bit. Jeff Michaelis of Cinema Judge and his wife passed away as we're speaking about a week ago. Jeff was a very amazing gentleman. I mean, he had no idea how much talent he had. I talked about it a lot on the podcast. You can go to Cinema Judge and listen to it. You can look up on the YouTubes the one time pre-strike he was able to interview an actor from Hollywood, and I had hoped we'd see a lot more, but Jeff and his wife were found dead. I don't know any details. It's devastated us at work. We're short people at work already because of military duty. I believe one of her colleagues broke his leg. He's out for a month. This has pretty much devastated Minneapolis TSA because both Heather on the checkpoint and Jeff in baggage were so well liked. I talked with Corey a bit before the podcast, and there's so much. I could just go on and on about just how crazy Jeff is. He was always extremely grateful that we mentioned him on our podcast. Anytime a comic-related show came in and he did it on his Cinema Judge, I'd mentioned it. And here's why I thought it was not... I mean, he was grateful, but he gets like 50,000 views on his YouTube page. But what's our subscriber base, Corey?
Around 4,000.
So he's way bigger people following him than us. And I know he returned the favor back and forth, so he's going to be missed. I will just leave with a story about Jeff to give you an idea of just what type of personality Jeff was. If there's a line of good taste, him and I are way over there on the other side of it. So one day, Chris and I were flying out, and at the time we did our screening of luggage in the lobby of the airport, Jeff happened to be in the particular pod we were flying out of, and we gave him his luggage. And Jeff was, "Oh, how are you doing, madame? You're lovely." He could schmooze it on with the best of them. How Heather didn't muzzle him, I don't know, to her chagrin, but she knew he was devoted to her. Anyways, as we're leaving, my wife's like, "Now, my suitcase is going to be okay, right?" Jeff just looks at her, no promises. About a week later, I come up to Jeff and I say, "Hey, you know what? Chris wants to know where her underwear went." Jeff kind of looks away. Can she have it back tonight? A year later, this is back when my wife is working with the city of St. Paul. She's walking with the deputy mayor, the number two. You go mayor, deputy mayor. They walk past the same pod. Jeff's working. And Jeff's like, "How are you ladies doing? Blah, 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 blah." And, you know, schmoozing. And then as they're walking away, Jeff goes, "You know, Chris, one of these days I probably should return your underwear to you." And the deputy mayor does a double take. And as they're walking away, "Chris, do I need to know more about this story?" Chris is like, no, you don't. As far as I know, I never did get that underwear back. It's been a rough week. I'm still not over it. The little things are getting to me, like seeing that his name's not on the schedule anymore. Not expecting him to come through the door at a certain time because you're like, "Hey, how you doing?" He's going to be missed. His wife is going to be missed. And it just, the world's a little darker place because they're gone. His stuff is up on Cinema Judge. I have no idea how long it's going to be there. I have no idea how long our podcast would be up. Now that we're across multiple things, if Corey and I were to stop doing it or just pass away. And so go enjoy what's up there and just share a little of him with us since we won't have any more. Corey, what are you freaking on?
First off, I just got hot news.
Ooh.
The group home has had a outbreak of COVID.
Oh, bloody hell.
So let me pull it up here. We had a staff member and a supported individual diagnosed with COVID today. Now, part of that is they're asking me if I can work. Part of it is it means that I have to, when I get to work, I have to put on full PPE and all of that. So for the people who say, "Oh, you know, COVID's over." No, I got it the first of the year.
I don't want to be a downer, Debbie, but Jeff and Heather just were getting over COVID.
Yeah. And it's not as fatal as it was if you've been vaccinated and you're taking care of yourself. That both times when I was in the hospital in late October and when I had COVID in January, both times the doctor said, you know, somebody at your age would be knocked down by this for a long time, but because you take care of yourself, because, you know, I'm tubby, but I exercise, I eat vegetarian, I eat too much vegetarian, but I eat vegetarian. Yes, potato chips are vegetarian. There's no meat in the in the potato chip bag that I have found yet. So make sure you're taking care of yourself. Exercise. Get those vaccinations, because COVID is still out there. People are still dying of it. People are still getting it. It's not as severe as it was, but if you haven't taken care of yourself, if you've got any risk, if you've got any risks around you, it's still bad. I still am more tired than I was before. And to be honest, I don't know if it's because of my work schedule or because of the fact that, you know, COVID does sort of run down your body for a while. One of my friends who got it very early, it was a year before he was able to start lifting weights and going to the gym and not being utterly exhausted all the time. So the second thing is, we just got an email. This is much more frivolous, by the way. Just got an email from DCB Service. It sounds like they've been getting a lot of the complaints that I have. We have noticed that there is a lot of continuing confusion regarding Marvel's solicitation. Specifically, for over a year now, Marvel has been putting items up in the pre-order prior to them being in their printed catalog. The reason for this, for these items are part of the previous month's pre-order, is that they are the first few weeks of the following month. Since DCB Service puts them up based on product code, these items that were available the previous month are no longer on the site when the pre-order goes up for the new month. To avoid missing any items you may want from solicitations that are not in any of the printed catalogs, we do have tools available in the download section of the site. There are Excel order forms for both the current month and the previous month. These order forms are broken down by publisher, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If customers do still miss items, you are welcome to send an email request for them to be added to your orders. And if they're available for us to orders, we will manually add them. This does not sound like a DCB Service thing. It sounds like a Marvel thing. Yeah. Marvel needs to get their shit together and solicit books the same time as they have them in the catalog. I know that they're with a book publisher now, and their distribution's with a book publisher now, and book publisher distribution is very different from comics. Book publishers solicit weekly, and that the bookstores order weekly, whereas comics you order monthly. But Marvel needs to sit down with their distributor and say, look, this is how we do it. I've already talked about a couple of books that I've missed, and DCB Service couldn't find them. It sounds like that's the reason why.
Well, case in point, there's two. We didn't get to the review, but Spectacular Spider-Man. No idea what it was when I had to order it, and then when it came out, and Weapon X, the miniseries. You know, I have an advantage. I visit the source every week, so I know what I'm missing and I can pick it up. You know, that's why I'm not too worried. They're really good at pulling stuff, which is why I have Ultimate Black Panther, Ultimate X-Men, whereas other people will not because it's selling out. But that, we're probably going to complain about it more until Marvel gets their act together.
Speaking of health, I have an update from Guandana Land. As you know, Guandana Land has a number of different imprints, one of which is Acheron Press, which is run by Brian Muehl, M-U-E-H-L. Health update. I'm happy to report that a few days ago, I was released from the acute rehab center and allowed to return home after 2.5 months hospital stay. I'm still on external oxygen and will be for a while. Eventually, I hope my stamina and body will improve to the point where I no longer need the external oxygen. I've recuperated to the point where I could do most of the things I need to do at home to be independent and live on my own. It's just slow going. I don't need a walker to move around. However, after about 5 minutes of doing pretty much anything, I need to rest for 5 to 10 minutes to catch my breath and let my blood oxygen levels come back up. So that's an adjustment for me and an exercise in learning patience. I have to readjust my expectations of how long it will take for me to accomplish things and plan accordingly. As most of you know, I am not a patient person. I am hoping to get approval to resume work at my quality management job remotely from my home from my pulmonologist in the next couple of weeks. I again want to take time to thank everyone for their prayers, well wishes, and support over the last 3 months as I've gone through this long journey of recovery from acute respiratory failure. I cannot tell you how much of a source of strength and comfort it's been to me to know I have so much love and support from all of you. I'm going to say this just for myself. When I went in the hospital at the end of October, the amount of people who checked on me, who messaged me, who said, hey, you're stuck in the hospital. I know people get bored there. Here's things to do. Or said nice things. When my sister passed away, same thing. When my mother was in the hospital, same thing. When I had COVID, same thing. For all the bitching and complaining and belly aching people do about social media is very good at people checking in, supporting you, caring about you, even if you've never met them. The things we have in common bind us together. One of the things I'm very proud of with my social media is I don't have a lot of people who are posting offensive stuff. They're not posting racist stuff. They're very much a supporting group. A lot of when a young artist puts up art, it's not a, oh, that's not any good. You're not going to be. Older artists will actually point out the things that they're doing really well and kind of give guidance on how to do better. If someone's talking about they're hitting an artist block, they get a lot of encouragement. Same with writers. When somebody announces that they've published a book or they've gotten a book contract, you see tons of hearts and congratulations and all of that stuff. As Joe said, because Joe and I are getting older, our friends are getting older. A lot of the people who work in comics, it's a young man's game, but there are a lot of people still in it. And the body doesn't react well to sitting at a drawing board for 8 to 12 hours a day. Having people cheer you on, check on you, give you recognition is one of the best things you could do when somebody is sick, somebody's not feeling good, somebody's going through depression or some other mental illness. I'm sad that people are going through this, but the fact that this guy who he's, you know, how do I know him? He's publishing public domain comics, but we've gotten to know him. So that it's not, oh, that guy, he hasn't put out any books in 2 weeks. What's the problem? To where, hey, heard you're not doing well. Checking in on you, seeing if there's anything we can do. That network of support is something that we need, especially this year in the U.S. when things are going to get nasty. People are going to get mean. It's a brutal election season. The people I don't agree with are already being mean, putting out cruel stuff, letting their racism fly, letting their hate fly. We've got to band together as a society to kind of fight against that. And it's sad that we still have to do that all the time. But it's good that we have these abilities to sort of hold each other up and help each other out. So, Joe, what are you geeking on?
My tooth is healing. I have a cavern in the back of my mouth. I was worried last week. I think I mentioned I thought I had had a dry socket from when I had my molar pulled out 2 weeks ago. I went into the dentist and they looked at it and I should say the dental assistant came and looked at it and she said, well, it's not quite it is dry, but it's not totally dry. That white stuff that I thought was bone was actually new jaw tissue forming. So I haven't had a tremendous amount of pain. I've been able to control it mostly with ibuprofen. The most I got to do is I got this hooked syringe and I go in with either warm salt water or diluted mouthwash and just rinse the socket after I eat something. I've actually still been eating a lot of soft foods, which is boring as hell, but I've been adding things to the diet. And other than super crumbly things, which I tend to, you know, you, hey, I just had a Pop-Tart, and then you rinse it out. Oh, there's where half the Pop-Tart went, right in the jawline. So anyways.
Pop-Tarts.
I've been rereading. I mentioned I read the Justice League International. I went through the two omnibuses at that. And then I pulled down the Thor Straczynski omnibus. And I read all through that. I think I'm at the final one, which ends up being a mini series where Rita Bay Bill goes off against Galactus or something. And Straczynski didn't write it, but it all ties in together. I, from there, pulled down the complete Michael Bendis Avenger, New Avengers. And I read through that over the week. Again, it was a rough week. So I just kind of sat, and when I wasn't screening bags, I just read. And I, again, I say this every time. I forget a lot of these runs. I've read them. Oh, I don't need to reread them. Yes, I do. I forgot a lot of the things that happened in the Bendis run with the Thor run. I also am utterly amazed at just how interconnected all this stuff was back then. These guys had to have planned out Civil War, Secret Invasion, Siege of Asgard, the return of Thor. Just everything just played out. And again, I still have several books to go through. I got to read The Avengers by Bendis and then Dark Avengers. And of course, Mighty Avengers. It's just what an awesome time. It all just tied together. And I think they're doing bits of it. Again, when I read, oh, brain fart, the Thor run that led up to War of the Realm.
Oh,
Aaron,
yeah.
Jason Aaron.
Yeah.
Yeah, the complete Jason Aaron. Again, same thing. I absolutely love this stuff. And this is why, while I may be liquidating the comics, I am trying to keep something together so I can read it later. Or, because I'll forget. And it's fun to reread things. Because, yeah, I always remember. Like, my favorite scene in the New Avengers is they're taking off, and Norm Osborn in his Patriot armor is jetting up to the jet. And Spider-Man just leaps out, boom, and the art just is incredible. And forgive me for not knowing who the artist is. I had it on the Facebook page and it disappeared. And he just goes down, he clocks Norman twice, drives him into a wall. Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say I enjoyed that, but I did. Boom, and he takes off. I think at the time, Cap was Bucky because Cap was dead. And then, of course, Cap came back.
The very next day.
Yep.
The Cap. Oh, no, I was thinking the cat. Never mind.
Yeah, no, same thing. It all ties into Marvel. But, and she was there. She was in it, too. So just had a lot of fun. One thing that I thought was interesting, though, especially because Doctor Strange was a lot involved or more involved in the New Avengers than wasn't. But I just. This whole, as I read on, it's like, okay, magic. Well, you know, there's a cost. You've been calling on Dormammu and Armageddon or whatever. You're going to go fight a war for 1,000 years. Oh, okay, whatever. Oh, you lose the ability to become Sorcerer Supreme because you couldn't do this. Really? I couldn't? Oh, you got it back because you learned to use dark magic. I did? Oh, there's a darkness every time you use it. Well, I'm going to hide it in your basement. Oh, geez. Guys, just. Let the magic users have fun. But then again, that, you know, part of it's the conflict. That's fine. I went to the Minnesota Toy Posse show over the weekend. It's set up in Bloomington. I think it's the same one we've went to a couple times where it was outdoors during the summer months. I don't really buy a lot of toys there because most of the guys that collect the toys are selling them collector prices. There's a lot of cheap stuff, and I'm not really there to dig. Plus, I had a time limit, unlike when I went to the Toy Posse or Minnesota Comic Exchange show. I actually only had like an hour and a half to get through. And I was able to get through a lot of comic dealers there. They actually take up two floors now. And of course, I bought tons of comics. The ones I'll share with you is I've got some more signed books. Corey, did you know I like signed books?
Really?
I do. I got Barbarella Volume 2, Number 6, signed by Sarah Hoyt. It's a 9.6 in CGC. Batman Vengeance of Bane, second print, with Chuck Dixon and Graham Nolan. Came with one of those DF certificates. A Painkiller Hellboy that had been signed by both Joe Quesada and Jimmy Palmiotti. Nothing ever happened with those guys. I have various Greg Horn art, but this was a Lady Death Medieval Witchblade that was signed by Greg, and it was very pretty. He knows how to draw women. And the last thing I picked up was signed by Jay Lee. It came from a crossover Star Trek Green Lantern number 1. Dynamic Forces Virgin Variant. Lest you think my escapades are just via various comic shows and stuff, you'd be wrong, because on the eBays, I picked up a Action Comics 1050 that Will Jack not only signed, but he did a little remark on it. So I get a little Supergirl sketch with that as well. And yes, I do like Supergirl sketches. So I picked up a Jerry Ordway Supergirl sketch on a Justice League United blank cover. And while it's not quite the Supergirl I like, because I like the 50s V and or the 70s, you know, the V neck, the puffy sweat, it's Jerry Ordway. Come on. And it's a headshot. So I can just ignore she just has her cape around her and there's no cleavage or poofy sleeves or anything like that. But come on, it's Jerry Ordway. Lest you think I'm just buying stuff like crazy, I'm selling things like crazy on the eBay. Literally, as we've been sitting here, three things have sold. So if you're interested, jump on board, head over to Crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z. If you see something you like, send me a quick note through the eBay system. Tell me you listen to this here podcast, and we'll cut a deal. I actually had one guy contact me. He said, hey, you sent me an offer, but I couldn't do it. Can you resend it? Quick answer, no, eBay doesn't let you. Easy answer, I just lowered the price, said, go for it quick. I hope you win it. And he did, because I'm trying to sell this stuff. You know, and as Corey can attest, I got 50 boxes of Mike stuff I haven't even looked at yet. But what did I do? I went to the Minnesota Toy Posse and bought more. And tomorrow, I'll probably go to another comic store. And I'm going over to Gruber's. Yes, it's an illness. But I do like reading it. Oh, a new comic book day is in 2 days. And my box is on the way. Oh, Corey, I just think I'm having a geekgasm. What are you geeking on?
Well, the first thing I am geeking on is not related to comics directly, but it does mean that I'll be buying some special stuff when we go out geeking next. And that is, well, I'm going to make it a story. I subscribe to Minnesota Monthly, which is odd because it comes out 8 times a year and not monthly. But then again, Gentleman's Quarterly doesn't come out quarterly, comes out monthly.
And it costs more than a quarter.
And the last couple of years of Entertainment Weekly came out monthly. But in it, they had a thing about average pay for different jobs. My job is kind of coded as customer service. Even though, yes, I spend most of my time on the phone, I also do reports and I do reviews and I do quality and all of that stuff. And it says, you know, here's the average rate. And I looked at it and I went, oh, I'm under that. Literally this morning. Oh, I'm under that. All of a sudden, I get you have a meeting at 12:15. Now, I, because of my anxiety disorder, if they spring a surprise meeting on me, where does my mind go first? Holy shit, what did I do? Things are going to be bad. The good thing was I only had a half hour to think about it. But no, I got a raise and they made it retroactive. So basically, I'm getting a rather large bonus, which is, okay, the raise is going back to this date. So all of the pay you missed that you would have gotten with the raise, you're going to get in a lump sum on Friday. And then your new salary takes effect on April 1st. So I have more money to go geeking with.
Yay!
The second thing I am geeking on, I think I told you, Joe, the Minnesota House of Representatives passed a measure putting aside money for a third major sporting event that they did not name.
Ooh!
And they did name, okay, we've got the Final Four, and I forget what the other one is, but they said, we cannot announce the third one until early April. The rumors have been flying that WrestleMania is coming to Minneapolis because the person who is in charge of U.S. Bank Stadium used to run. Well, no, he didn't used to run. He used to work for the WWE. He was one of their VPs. So the rumor is we are getting WrestleMania next year.
Yay!
Now, for me, it's not just WrestleMania that's the big deal because, let's face it, seats are $400 each. I'm not going to be buying a seat for WrestleMania.
I probably will.
But whatever city gets WrestleMania gets all of the indies showing up. Philly has WrestleMania this week. There's a website that counted up all the shows. There are going to be over 30 independent wrestling shows from Monday to Sunday, WrestleMania week. I'm going to be going to all of those, probably as press. I will go to as many as I can. There's also WrestleCon that goes to the home city of WrestleMania. WrestleCon, it's not just show up and get autographs. They also have promotions do shows during the convention. Last year, New Japan had matches during WrestleCon. TNA Wrestling had matches during WrestleCon. Game Changer Wrestling usually finds a building and runs shows from 10 in the morning to 3 a.m. if they're allowed. So that will be crazy, and it means I have a year to sort of get ready for the crazy.
And we will probably, I don't know, we might have to put the podcast on a two-week hiatus or just fill in make a lot of fill-ins or something. Especially if you're going to be running around with your head cut off, and you know the airport's going to be busy.
Oh, yeah, the airport will be insane. You're not going to get any time off.
No, no.
Comic-wise.
Although, I won't be able to do time off until November because I know my old buddy Turbo, who we've had on the podcast, he's coming up. He's been to two WrestleManias and he says he'll come to town for that. So maybe.
Comic wise, I read the first issue of What If Alien, which is written by Paul Reiser. And, you know, they said, oh, it's written by Paul Reiser. Well, concept by Paul and Leon Reiser, written by Hans Rodkanoff and Adam Goldberg. I liked it. I thought it was a lot of fun. It showed some nuance to his character in Aliens, who just kind of came off as a Weasley corporate guy, but there's more to him than that. Which, of course, Paul Reiser would want to do that because, you know, actors, when an actor goes into a role, one of the things that we're taught, you know, in acting is you have to create the backstory for this character. So he goes into all of that he created. Really well done. And you don't need to have really strong memories of the movie Aliens because it hits all the points where you go, oh, yeah, I remember that now. I have read Giant Size Fantastic Four, which is by Fabian Nyasasia. And in it, he picks up where the status quo of Atlantis is. He introduces a whole new character, which puts a big twist on what's going on with the Submariner and Atlantis. And it's a character who, a lot like the Submariner, he's not strictly a bad guy. He's not strictly a good guy. He's kind of straddles that in between because of the circumstances he's in. It was a wonderful addition to the Fantastic Four, and one of the few times Baby and Neo-Sasia has got to play with the Fantastic Four. Giant-sized Spider-Gwen, very different from any other book that Marvel is putting out. Again, it uses almost a cartoony manga style, and it is about, it's sort of setting the stage for Spider-Gwen to leave the Earth she's on. And I really enjoyed it. These giant-sized books have been a fantastic read so far. Every one of them has been well worth the money, and the backups are well chosen. I've been enjoying that a lot. I also got the Heroes Reborn stuff that they did in 2000 when we were over at Minton Box. I had not read those since they came out, so that's 24 years ago. And it basically is what happened to the Heroes Reborn world after the Fantastic Four, Captain America, the Avengers, everybody left. And for someone who did not work on those books, Chris Claremont really had a great grasp of the characters that have been introduced. He introduces his own characters. And the thing that I like the most is it's a world where Dr. Doom has stepped into the power vacuum. And it's a shame they did not do much more with it, because after reading that, it's really clear that Claremont was setting up for a series to be set on the Heroes Reborn Earth. But I guess it didn't sell well enough, so they just kind of let it go. But I miss those, what they called fifth week events, because comics are set up to, okay, this comic comes out week one, et cetera, et cetera. And then the fifth week, they would do something special because they didn't have any books, quote, scheduled for that week, unquote. Now it's, those are where the books that are late sort of end up. They don't do the fifth week events anymore. I think partly because the sales declined over time, because people would go, well, they don't affect continuity at all. I don't care if something affects continuity if it's well done. Come on, man.
Come on.
Believe it or not, kids, you've listened to us blather on about funny books and pretty much only funny books for an hour and a half.
We'll change that. We promise. We promise.
And as we say every week, the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic that you like the most, Joe.
Corey, why do golfers bring two pair of pants? Well, in case you got a hole in one.
Get a hole in one. Even the crickets don't like that one.
Yeah, well, I was going to tell you a joke about time travel, but you didn't like it.
Ugh.
Hit my music. Funk is on a roll.
Done, bitches!